It is a great pleasure for me to introduce Ghislain Guigon. So Ghislain Guigon has defended his PhD at the University of Geneva, and he's now assistant lecturer. Is it the proper term in English? Assistant lecturer in this same University of Geneva. He has worked in several domains, mainly in metaphysics, also in philosophy of religion, and also in history of philosophy a little bit. In metaphysics, he concentrates on the theory of resemblance, of explanation, and on the theory of modalities. In history of philosophy, he has worked especially on Alexios Meinong and also on Spinoza, and he has a lot of papers in the greatest journals like Analysis, Philosophical Studies, and so on. And he has also published a collection of papers, of original papers in metaphysics with Gonzalo Rodriguez Pereira, which is entitled Nominalism About Properties, New Essays. So today he's going to present us the alchemist theory of composition as identity.
Merci Jean-Baptiste, merci Claudine pour avoir organisé cet événement. Je vais dire juste quelques mots en français avant que je commence. Je fais ma présentation en anglais juste parce que je sais qu'il y a quelques intervenants qui vont mieux me comprendre en anglais qu'en français. Mais j'ai fait des handouts en français pour vous qui étaient à l'entrée. Donc là, vous avez la version originale sous-titrée, ce qui est pratique. Voilà. Et puis, je cultive mon accent français en anglais. Donc normalement, vous allez vous sentir à la maison. Ça n'est pas dépaysé. Et puis, évidemment, aussi, vous pourrez me poser vos questions en français à la fin de la présentation, si vous voulez. OK. So, the view I will discuss today is inspired by what Occam says on composition. I insist on the inspiration. I'm not a medievalist, and I have too much respect for history of philosophy to claim that this is an interpretation of Occam. So it's I use some Occam material at the beginning, but as you will quickly see, it becomes something very non-Occamist at the end. So first for the inspiration, I'll try to make it. Okay, maybe it works better. So that's Mr. Occam. So for the inspiration, so in contemporary metaphysics we call composition as identity, the view that the whole, the fusion is identical to its parts. And it seems that Occam has endorsed such a view, a version of this view, but he has endorsed a version of it that is especially strange, especially odd for contemporary readers. And it's this oddity that is interesting to me. So something you have on the handout, so that's some evidence, some textual evidence that he maintained some sort of composition as identity for substantial wholes. So substantial wholes have mainly two parts, matter and form, and he says things like that beyond these parts, there is no third entity. Or in the second quote, over and above matter and form, it, the substance, is nothing other than a certain composite that is nothing other and above, nothing over, that's all, other than its parts joined together. Okay, so that's what he says about substantial wholes, but I am mainly interested in what he says about artifacts, because that's where things become a little weird. So that's what Occam says on artifacts. I will read this. But concerning artifacts, one part can remain distinct from another, which means that in the natural order of things, the parts can exist together all at once, even when they are not united. Accordingly, it is not the case that always and necessarily this all is this part when they are existing. It is only the case that it is these existing parts when the parts are united in the required manner and situated in the right place and in the appropriate manner. So here, as you can read, so he maintains some sort of identity relation. He said the whole is the part. What is puzzling about this passage is that it seems to think that the identity is both temporary and contingent. That's weird. I will not talk so much about the temporal dimension here. I will focus on the modal dimension mainly because I cannot talk about, I don't have time. But everything I will say about the modal dimension can be same it at this meeting, this about the temporal dimension. So why is it puzzling? Oh, before, why does Occam maintain such a view? It has to do with his nominalism but relations. So here's the, I think, as I understand, Occam is motivation for maintaining this view about artifacts. So according to him, whether something composes a whole, it has to do with how the parts are related. Sometimes that's contingent, for artifacts that's contingent. But Occam maintained there are no things like relations in the man-independent world. So here I'm following Claude Parnassus' interpretation of Occam's nominalism. He thinks that Occam is a kind of trop nominalist about monadic properties, but he is a nostere or nostrich nominalist about relations. And then you get this kind of view. If you have this few assumption, the way that some wholes are merely contingently identical with their part makes some sense, I think. Okay. But there is an obvious problem. Which is that this view seems to be absurd given Leibniz's law. So that's my... I will use this as an example. You can think of physiorship if you prefer, but I use Occam's razor. There are fewer parts, so it's easier. So this is Occam's razor. I call it Reznor. It has three parts, a blade called Blenda, a handle that I call Ansel, and a joint that I call John. So suppose Reznor is composed of Blenda, Ansel, and John today. Given composition as identity, Reznor is Blenda, Ansel, and John today. I use the dot quotes only to mean together, basically. But given that composition is contingent, Blenda, Ansel, and John might not have composed Reznor today, and by Leibniz's law you can derive that Blenda, Ansel, and John might not have been identical to Blenda, Ansel, and John today. And that's obviously absurd given the necessity of identity. Okay, so this view seems very absurd. There is a second problem. The second problem is that Occam also seems to have endorsed a view that today we call priority pluralism. So priority pluralism is the view that the parts are ontologically prior to the whole they compose. And I give you a quote that Magali translated for me, in which he seems to maintain such a view in this way. To the parts are prior to the whole, and no more seems to agree with this. But obviously, the view that composition is identity also seems incompatible with the view that the parts are prior to the whole. The argument is straightforward. Just imagine identity is supposed to be reflexive, ontological priority is supposed to be asymmetrical and therefore irreflexive, so you get an absolute. Okay, I will go more formal later in this argument, but just to get the idea so far. So the view I call Occam's composition as identity is the conjunction of these three claims. You get composition as identity. So just for the notation, I use bold variables for plural variables. So you have to read it in the plural. And I use this variable for singular variables. So Occam's composition as identity is the conjunction of these three claims, composition as identity, contingency of composition, and priority pluralism. Let me tell you that I am not interested in the truth of this proposition. In the literature, you find philosophers who defend them, philosophers who oppose them. It's not my problem. I am interested in the conjunction of this thesis, of the quotinability. I've identified two problems with this position. One is Leibniz's law argument against the first two propositions, another against composition as identity in priority pluralism. And what I want to do in this talk mainly is just to give you a solution to these two problems. And it's basically using one technique to solve both problems. And the technique I will use to solve both problems is what I call advanced counterpart theoretic tools. So these are developments of Lewis's original counterpart theory that I've developed recently. And to be completely honest with you on my motivation, I am more interested in showing you how great these tools are than in defending the view of composition as identity. So this is for my goals. Another interesting thing that I want to share with you, there are two ways you can read the thesis that composition is contingent. You can read it as meaning that you allow for what I call merely the possibility of no composition, which is the idea that you have some parts, they are related together, you disassemble them, there's no more whole. Or you can interpret it as allowing for the possibility of what I call mereological switching. Think of ordinary thesisship scenarios, you replace the part, you have the same all but other parts. That's mereological switching. You can maintain the contingency of composition and only maintain what I call the possibility of no composition. What's interesting about this, if you know your mereology well, is that if you allow for the possibility of mereological switching, then you have violations of the extensionality of mereology. Whereas if you only allow for the possibility of no composition, all you have is a failure of universalism. And I will interpret the Occamist as only allowing for no composition, for the possibility of no composition. And this is related to actually what Claudine was saying before. So I think Occam, like Abelard, some sort of mereological essentialist. And so, fine, given that relations are contingent, you can have failures of universalism, but you won't have anything like mereological switching. Still, I will tell you how I can interpret these two possibilities in my framework. Okay. Here's where I insist that this is not a talk in history of philosophy. First, it's not obvious that Occam has the problem I think he has, because the medieval notion of identity is somewhat different from our notion of identity. Maybe they don't accept Leibniz's law. So I want to be careful with this. And second, it's very obvious that Occam will not like my solutions to his problems, to what I think is his problem. Occam is an Aristotelian philosopher, and my solutions are very non-Aristotelian in many ways. Okay. Good. So I start with the first problem I introduced to you. So this is a more formal rendering of this problem. So this is Leibniz's law argument against composition as identity and the contingency of composition. Blender, Ansel, and John compose Reznor today. Blender, Ansel, and John might not have composed Reznor today, so one and two are just an instance of the view that composition is contingent. From one, you can derive by composition as identity that Blender, Ansel, and John are identical to Reznor today. From two, you can derive by composition as identity that Blender, Ansel, and John and Reznor might not have been identical today. And from five by three, and four by and Leibniz's law, you can derive that Blender, Ansel, and John, and Blender, Ansel, and John might not have been identical to. Okay, so this I said already. The key step in this argument is four, which seems to be a claim of contingent identity. If you know your Kripke. You know, this is problematic. We think that identity is supposed to be necessary. We should not be committed to contingent identities. But as you, I hope, know, David Lewis already proposed before my birth, long before my birth, to block this kind of argument using his counterpart theory. He was interested in case of material constitution mainly. And this is a very similar argument. The difference, however, is that Lewis's counterpart theory is a singular logic. It's really a singular language. And what we need here is a plural counterpart theory. And this is what I want to introduce you to the utility of going plural if you go counterpart theorist. Okay, so this is a short introduction to Lewis's original counterpart theory. So in Lewis's counterpart theory, you have the counterparts, they are what we call world-bound possibilia. Possibilia means that they exist in possible worlds and only in worlds that are possible. They are world-bound, which means that they exist in at most one of them, in exactly one of them. each. A counterpart of something is a representative of this thing in other possible world. It plays its role. It's really your delegate in other possible world. The relevant representation relation, counterpart-hood, is a matter of context sensitivity, context sensitive overall similarity. And it's one-one, and that's the key point. It's a one-one relation. So that's the understanding of counterpart-hood we get from Lewis. For all x and y, x is a counterpart of y if and only if x is similar to y, and there is no set in x's world such that set is more similar to y than x is. Importantly, counterpart relation can vary within a single context, within a single sentence, depending on how you describe objects or on how you designate them. That would play an important role later. And this is the semantics that Lewis gives for Jerry Modell claims. A is necessarily F is true if and only if every possible counterpart of A is F. R is possibly F is true if and only if some possible counterpart of A is F. Okay, so Lewis doesn't use the word possible here, but there is a reason why I use it, because later I will allow for impossible counterparts. That's why I need this. Lewis's counterpart theory, I think, is great to analyze singular Jerry Modell claims. It's very poor to analyze plural Jerry Modell claims, like the following. So these are plural Jerry Modell claims. The Rolling Stones could have had another guitarist. The students could be surrounding the Sorbonne right now. There are critics who possibly admire one another, only one another. The sons of Fyodor Karamazov are necessarily brother. So these are Jerry Modell claim. You modelize about some things, but these are many things you're pluralizing on, you're modelizing on, and you need some kind of collective reading, I think, of this sentence to get the right interpretation of them. Okay. So what you need, I think, in particular, is a plural understanding of the counterpart relation. So that's my plural understanding of counterpart-hood. For all x and y, x are counterparts of y if and only if x are similar to y, and there are no set in the world x are in such that set are more similar to y than x are. And the notion of identity for pluralities is extensional. Yeah. Okay. In some contexts, I think it's fine to interpret plural counterpart-hood distributively. If you have a distributive reading, then you will have something like this. So you will say that if x are counterparts of y, then you have a one-one relationship between things that are among the x and things that are among the y. No problem. But I think it's just wrong to interpret every plural Jerry Modell claims like this. So if you give you an example. So this is a counterpart theoretic interpretation of 6. So 6, remember, is the claim that the Rolling Stone could have had another guitarist. So that's the way you will translate it in counterpart theory, I think. Some X is the guitarist of the Rolling Stones. And there is a world W, some Y, and some Z in W, such that Y are counterparts of the Rolling Stone. Z is the guitarist of Y, and Z is not a counterpart of X. So if you read... if you read plural counterpart-hood here distributively, then you get something absurd, because if you think that the counterparts of the Rolling Stone are the counterparts of the singer of the Rolling Stone, of the guitarist, of the bassist, then that doesn't make any sense. There has to be a counterpart of the guitarist of the Rolling Stone among the counterparts of the Rolling Stone. But that's not what we want here. So six makes full sense, and if you have a collective reading of plural counterpart-hood, it makes sense too. What you have to do simply is to focus on collective similarities between the Rolling Stone and the counterparts. You have to think about what they do together, when the band has been formed, things that is really collective about them. So my, to put things quickly, so my defense also of plural counterparthood and collective counterparthood has to do with my defense of collective similarity. That's something I defend in my PhD dissertation, and this is an application of this. All right, so now I have everything in place to solve my first problem. All I need is to distinguish between two kinds of plural counterpart relation. So first there is a component counterpart relation and there is a composite counterpart relation. So when we conceive of Blender, Ansel, and John as parts, we are conceiving of them through the component counterpart relation or qua component. What is going on when you conceive of them as component is that you attach great importance to individual respects of similarity between them. For instance, it can be their individual origin, the tree Ansel comes from, the Hiram mine Blender and John come from, such kind of things. Or it can be the color, the matter, whatever you want, something individual, something intrinsic. And you don't attach importance to the way they are related. That's a component counterpart relation. On the other end, you can also conceive of them as Reznor, which is qua all, qua composite. And if you do so, so that would be the composite counterpart relation, you have to attach importance to relations between them two. That's basically the idea. OK. Something I will go quickly on, because I don't want to spend too much time on this. There are two ways you can go for your composite counterpart relation. Either you attach only importance to relations, to the way these things are assembled, related. And then that's what I call loose composite counterpart relation. You can have composite counterparts of Blender, Ansel, and John that will have nothing in common with them individually. And if you select your composite counterpart relation like that, then you will have a possibility of homological switching. And then you can have failures of extensionality. But you can also go anchored with your composite counterpart relation, which means that you attach importance to both individual respects of similarity and relations. The result is that, so these are sets of counterparts. The result is that the set of your anchored composite counterpart is the intersection of your set of component counterparts and set of loose composite counterparts. Why? Because for the anchored composite counterpart, you attach importance to what is important for this and for what is important to this. And if you go anchored, then all you have is the possibility of no composition. So the funny thing about this is that depending on how you select your similarity relations, then you get different homologies. So go similarity first and you have different homologies. Okay. Now I can show you my solution. So there are two readings of the proposition 4, which is, I think, the problematic proposition in the argument. One reading that allows for homological switching, and that's the way you should interpret it counterpart theoretically. There is a world W, some X and some Y, such that X are the unite component, counterparts of Blender, Ansel, and John, and W. Y are the unite L, loose composite counterparts of Blender, Ansel, and John in W, and X are distinct from Y. So if you want a scenario to illustrate this, so what is going on, for instance, in this world in W? Suppose you have selected your component counterparts by focusing on individual origin of the things. So you have objects that are very similar to Blender, Ansel, and John with respect to their origin, but they are disassembled. They have never been assembled together. On the other hand, there are objects that have been assembled together that are less similar to them individually, but are more similar with respect to their relations. Perhaps these things function together as blade for Occam's head, I don't know, for as a razor. And this will be the composite counterpart of Ansel and Angel. Okay. And this is the translation of 4 that merely allows for no composition. There is a world W such that Blender, Ansel, and John have component counterpart X in W, but no anchored composite counterparts in W. So here again, the thing is that there are objects in this world that are very similar to them individually, but they have never been assembled together So there will not be the uncored counterparts. All right. What matters is that neither 4 prime nor 4 second are absurd. What is absurd is 5, and is the translation of 5. I have no problem with that. But what is important is that you cannot derive 5 from 4 prime or 4 second using Leibniz's law and 3. I will not show you why. I will move on quickly. We can discuss this later. Okay, this was my solution to my first problem. I will go quicker on my second problem. So this is the Leibniz's law argument against composition as identity and priority pluralism. Blender, Ansel, and John compose Reznor today. Blender, Ansel, and John are ontologically prior to Reznor today. Follows by priority pluralism. Blender, Ansel, and John are identical to Reznor today. Blender, Ansel, and John are ontologically prior to Blender, Ansel, and John today. And 12 is absurd because ontological priority is irreflexive. So what I propose to do to solve this problem is to use counterpart theory again. And that's very controversial because people who like notions of ontological priority, they're usually what we call neo-Aristotelian, so they think these notions are primitive, they think it cannot be analyzed modally, counterpart theory is something to analyze modality. Fair enough, I'm not interested in conceptual analysis. I'm doing something else. I want to replace the Aristotelian notion of ontological priority. I don't want to analyze it. I'm not interested in this. So here, I'm just using some tools I've developed somewhere else. I have given a counterpart theoretic analysis of grounding, and I'm just applying it to the case of ontological priority. I will click pass on this. So there is a notion of ontological priority, which is really within a structure and something that is what I call cross-structural. For instance, you can think that my cells are ontologically prior to you as a whole, but that's not really interesting. We are interested in the relationship between my cells and me. So that's what I call ontological priority within a structure, and I focus on this. Okay. So my understanding, I don't read philosophers when I want to understand what ontological priority is. I read engineers. The way I understand ontological priority is, I think, the way engineers understand what it is for something to play the foundation role in a structure. So here are some quotations by people working in house reparation. You can visit their website. They're very good at repairing foundations. And here is a quote from people working in bridge construction. And what they say, both, is something very specific. What is specific for them about foundations is that if it is damaged, your foundation, then it's very likely to create huge problems in your whole structure. If the foundation is damaged, it's even very likely that the whole structure will collapse. This is not like it with parts of elements of your structure that are foundational. You can break your window, it will not destroy your whole house. It's basically the end. So I use this to develop what I call a demolition model of ontological priority. So I'm very proud of my little drawing. So here's the idea of the demolition model of ontological priority. So suppose that demolishers want to demolish exactly one of 2 floors of the small tower, that's my small tower, but not both of them, and they use explosives to do this. Compare 2 scenarios. In the first scenario, they place the explosive at the foundation level, so that's the scenario A. In scenario B, they place their explosive here at the top level. And the question is, in which scenario is it most likely that the whole structure will collapse? In which scenario is it most likely that only one of the 2 levels will collapse? Is the right question to ask. And the answer to this question is in scenario B. Suppose there's only this wall that breaks and the whole thing collapses. Suppose there's only this wall that breaks and only the top floor collapses. You can account for this in terms of closeness relations between worlds, like this. Some world in which the top floor is demolished and the foundation remains intact is closer to a world than any world in which the foundation is demolished and the top floor remains intact. So that's basically the idea, a counterfactual idea of ontological priority. No, forget that. Okay. I stop in less than 5 minutes. So first step to my counterpathetic account of ontological priority based on this demolition model of ontological priority. So this is a counterfactual account, as you can see. Oh, it is very close to the Stalnaker-Lewis similarity analysis of counterfactuals. That's basically the model. And you can read it like this. X are ontologically prior to Y is true in W if and only if some world where X exists but Y don't exist, that's the way you should read it, is closer to our world than any world in which X don't exist but Y exists. Importantly, the worlds that are involved here can be impossible. Why? Because there are lots of philosophers who think that you have such relations of ontological priority between things that necessarily coexist. And then if you want to break the link between them, you will have to go impossible. But that's okay. This, I think, is in line with what Occam says on compositions. So yeah, the interpretation that I give of Blenda, Ansel, and John are ontologically prior to Reznor is some world in which Blenda, Ansel, and John exist, but Reznor doesn't exist. It's closer to a world than any world in which Reznor exists, but Blenda, Ansel, and John don't exist. I think this is in line with the Occamist thought that worlds in which the parts are disassembled are possible, but worlds in which you have the whole without the parts, this is impossible because of mereological essentialism. So this seems really to confirm there, to confirm Occam's view. Now, obviously, as I'm a counterpart theorist, I don't take it seriously when I talk of things existing in many possible worlds. What I have in mind is really things at their counterparts, their representative in other possible world. So that's my counterpart theoretic account of this. X are ontologically prior to Y is true at W if and only if a world in which X have counterparts but Y have no counterparts is closer to our world than any world in which Y have counterparts but X have no counterparts. Now, just to finish, the solution of my problem. Here I just translate the claim of ontological priority that were problematic in my second Leibniz's argument in terms of counterpart theory using the tools that I've developed. So you have plural counterparthood in play and my counterpart theoretic account of ontological priority. Here I assume composition as identity. What matters is that my counterpart theoretic translation of 10 prime is not absurd. It makes sense because you have two different relation of counterparthood in play here. So different things, different counterparts. Where 12 prime is absurd, as it should be, because 12 is really absurd. So this is how it solves the problem. And I stop here. Thank you.